This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today, Lanny Della Rocca is with us. He's the founder of a wonderful journal in Southern Florida. He's a practicing poet with two books behind him, two chapbooks, and he's doing a lot for other poets. Lanny, give us a poem.
Thank you, Grace. Sure. This one is called Ode to Scarecrow. You point both ways and tell the girl you have no brain because your head is full of straw. She upends the nail behind your back. The crows all about you scoff as you slide. To Oz, you and the girl sing like kids skipping through a dream. There will be other friends and the journey will be long. See how the girl skips with her basket and dog. She will never wake up, not unless you sleep in your world with an old broom up your back to keep you aloft in a strange field. There's a storm coming. Mm-hmm. Which of you is dreaming? Which one is going home?
Wonderful. The voice of Lanny Della Rocca. I think when you take the power of fable added, transformed to poetry, it's a double whammy. It works every time.
Yeah.
I wanted to start by talking about your poetry journal because I think you're doing so much in Florida. You are really keeping the poetry community alive. You're central to the activities. So the South Florida Poetry Journal has been in existence how long and what do you do?
I started it in 2016. I actually started in February of 2016 with a thing online called Interview with a Poet, three poets, five questions each month. And what I did is I would interview poets and, you know, post it on the website. And it was in writing. This was before Zoom. So anyway, that went to May. And then in May, I thought, you know what, let's expand from just doing interviews to actual poetry. So May of 2016 is when I actually started the poetry in South Florida Poetry Journal.
Is it a monthly?
It's a quarterly. Comes out February, May, August, and November of each year.
How much of your time does it take?
Wow.
Does it take every day? Do you do something every day?
Communicate
or decide or do something official so that it's really a central organizing principle in your life?
Absolutely. I retired a few months after I started. It was May 2016. I retired August of 2016. So that freed me up to do some work. But I'm not alone in doing this. Michael Mackin O'Mara, who I've known for 40 years, is the managing editor as well as co-publisher with me. So between the two of us, we do the bulk of all the work. And then we have about two or three or four editors. And then we have a series of readers who come in and out who read for us. So I also do some reading. For each day, I'm reading new poems coming in, new submissions. It's not a daily thing. It's work, you know.
Just to talk about the staff. The producer of a staff, that is pretty awesome, actually. Well, wow. I want to hear two poems from you so that they know Lanny the poet, and then we'll get back to some of the cogs and wheels in your journal. So sure. Give us two together, set them up, and let us know who you are.
Okie dokie. This one, all these poems basically are fairly new in the last 5-6 months. So this is called Obeyed. I take off my clothes while morning takes off her hissing veil, like a woman with a magic opal at her forehead. In a fish-spiced canal, the sun is a child at play. Light, a feast of shapes, the new sky sees itself trapezoids in blue. Everything is a breath of earth, a song about every drowsy town. Then one poinsettia flower tumbles from its red story, truer than my eyes stung with green April, and then a break of warm rain, and then a skywire spits its secret code. But I am not moved by how the world meets the thrumming trees halfway to Jesus, as I am struck by its quiet little spells, smart and almost wicked, so adept at the clean invisible as to trick the birds with grace bright as fever. And I'll do another one. This is In a Single Bound. This references what is now Kennedy Airport, but I'm sure you remember before it was Kennedy, it was Idlewild, if you remember, before Kennedy was killed. Anyway, this is from a school trip when I was about 7, 8 years old. It's called In a Single Bound. After we stepped from the jet's cockpit with its menagerie of dials and switches, we linked hands in a line of little candy puffs of blue, beige, and red along Idlewild's Pan Am terminal, where disembodied voices roiled and tumbled like helpless, invisible clothes in a huge, cold machine. But it's the body I remember most, twisted in a blood splat at the bottom of an escalator, where a woman in a yellow summer dress screamed like Ann Darrow at the sight of Kong. A man in a gray jacket, black tie, and black-framed glasses ditched his briefcase and jumped. Clark Kent trying to hug a polished floor. Miss Kennedy, like a clean hen in a lilac dress, corralled us under her wing, pulled us away from the star-shaped suicide. But it was just a television show to me, without commercials.
You know, you're beautiful. Breath of Earth, your first poem, Halfway to Jesus. That is, which just really is very vivid, very beautiful. Some of those images I just wrote down. The Feast of Lights, was that a correct image?
Yeah. A Feast of Shapes. Yeah.
Yeah. And your second poem, Harking Back to Memory, is that a great database for you going back?
Oh, sure. I think every poet mines their history, right? Mines that you go back to childhood, go back to day, you know, years past to pull poems out of that, you know.
And you have been writing since 1980. You've been publishing. What do you remember as a five-year-old about who you were that made you know that someday you would see the world through language? Who was that little boy?
Well, he was a little boy who knew something about wanting to write before he actually learned to write, before he learned the alphabet. I used to, you know, before I went to school at 5 years old, when I was 4 years old or whatever, I remember sitting down with paper and pencil and just scribbling and not words, but it was just scribbling. And then once I learned the alphabet and learned to write, I started writing little stories. And then in 1968 was when I actually started writing poetry after hearing our English teacher brought in an old Victrola of Basil Rathbone. You remember Sherlock Holmes, right? And, you know, he put on Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven and Annabel Lee and all this. And I was just struck. I mean, you know, before that, it was Wordsworth and all these Victorians. And I just, that didn't do anything for me. But when I heard Poe, you know, his repetition and his imagery and the dark brooding, I was a teenager, you know, so this really appealed to me. So I wrote my first poem right there in English class in 1968. And then I didn't, like I said, I didn't start actually publishing until 1980, but I had been writing long before that. So, yeah.
Don't you agree that you came out wired as a writer? Don't you agree?
Yes.
I do too. I just don't think there's any other explanation for it. Loving the hieroglyphics on the page, wanting to break the code. Imagine you writing little stories as soon as you could figure out those codes.
Sure.
I love that about writers. And I believe everyone says the same thing they wrote as children.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy that you brought up Edgar Allan Poe, because he is one of the greatest American poets and is not seen that way, is not taught in academia. But I agree with you. Look what he did for you.
Sure.
He revitalized you.
Yeah, because up until then, we were reading all these Victorian poets, 19th century poets, and I was bored. I would sit in class and just, you know, start to fall asleep when he started reading things. But when he brought in that record player, that Victrola, and, you know, Once Upon a Midnight Dreary as I... that was, you know, I was 13, 14 years old. I was like, whoa, this is fantastic. You know, spooky, you know, atmospheric. And I just was turned on.
Where were you raised?
I was in Long Island, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was 1967, 68. So it was the height of the psychedelic era, you know, and the Beatles and all this. And so I just was... it just turned me on. I was like, wow, this is for me, you know?
I love to hear what triggers poets, because their emotional lives are like no others, really. Let us have another poem. Lenny Della Rocca is here with us. He is in charge of a very fine national poetry magazine, and he has really created community in Florida.
Okay, this is called The Invention of Wishes. And so here they are, full of everything they were. The daybreak in them hasn't moved into noon. A slice of orange sun in the clouds of their faces, in the dark-eyed, faraway storm of them. And a trace of them is moonbound with a lust for choir and star. And they want a house of girls, boys glorious and grateful for clear weather. They want ancestors to live the lives of my daughters and sons. They want my necessity for Sunday light, however caught in the sun's riptide. My adoration for them is skybound. And now shut-eyed expectation rises from the mouths of spectrum children who invented them and believe in them, because there's a song about them, a song without words, until now.
You have a very nice way of putting words together, choir and star, and what was the expectation?
Shut-eyed expectation.
The way you put words together, you get a double charge from them. That is really kind of inimitable with your writing. Not everyone does that. But I do notice that all of your work is kind of one shape, the verticality, which tells me something about your energy, your writing energy. So do you want to talk about how you come upon the shape, the long, narrow shape with the shorter lines? What happens to you to make that on the page?
It started organically. I started, you know, these poems were eventually coming to the shape. I had some longer lines and shorter lines, like we all do. But then all of a sudden, I noticed some of the poems were kind of shaped so that there was a longer line in the beginning and a longer line in the middle, and then it trailed off, and then a longer line at the end. So I decided I was going to purposely shape them so that they look like a big E, a big capital E on the page. And I just became obsessed. So all this year, since like February or so, I've been writing these poems in that shape. And I made some rules for myself. It can't go beyond a single page. It has to have the long first line, the long middle line, and the long last line. And the number of lines above that middle line are the same number of lines as there are below it. So when you get to the middle line, if you've gone through 16 lines, there's another 16 lines after it. So that's symmetrical. And then what I try to do, I don't always get it, it's not perfected yet, but what I try to do is make that long middle line the volta, the turn in the poem. Mm. And sometimes it works and sometimes it don't. It's a discipline. This forces me to cut more than it does to write, because I have to stay on one page and it has to be that shape. So a lot of times stuff that would be longer on the page has to be cut or trimmed or whatever. So it keeps me central to where the poem is heading. And I try to think of it, and this wasn't my idea. I think it was Tracy Brimhall who said, you know, think of the poem, the title as the front door, and the poem is the house. And you come in the front door and you walk through the poem to the back door where you exit. And if you can walk through the house without stumbling, without having any dark places where you fall over and stop, then, you know, you've succeeded. And so that's what I tried to do. And this shape helps me adhere to that. So.
Wow. Am I glad you spoke about that? Because I had not counted the lines. I had not really looked at your organization. Yeah. But when I read your work, I felt someone was in charge. I felt someone is in control of this poem. And now I know why. Mm-hmm. Because we feel grounded. We feel a discipline. We feel a wholeness. And I'm so glad you unraveled that for me. Now I'm going to go back and count lines. But that is truly the most important thing about your discipline is that it's not noticeable. It is smooth as silk, effortless, because when you really use form, form is not an axe in the head.
Sure.
You know, it's a piece of, it's really a piece of silk. Yeah. So let's have another poem and hear your silky narrative.
Okay. I might add that I forsake line breaks for these, for this form. You know, when looking at these, you might look at it and say, well, you know, what you should do is cut it here or bring this back up around and loop it around. And I don't care so much about the line breaks as I do about the aesthetics of that poem. So right or wrong, that's what I'm doing. So, okay. This one is called The Neighborhood of Make-Believe. Now, this was a poem by Thomas Lux. I just read his new and selected. Of course, Tom Lux just died, what, two, three, 4 years ago. So I read his new and selected, and in there was a poem called The Neighborhood of Make-Believe. And I thought, oh, man, that's such a great title. I have to write a poem, my own poem, based on that title, you know, which I did. And so I'll set it up by saying, of course, the title, The Neighborhood of Make-Believe, is Tom Lux's title. But then it starts off with a line from Penny Lane, which I am such an avid Beatles fan. So I a lot of my poems have Beatles stuff in it. Mm-hmm. And then so there's a line from Penny Lane at the very first. And then it mentions Crabalaka Fishwife, which Beatle fans will recognize from the song I Am the Walrus, of course, also by the Beatles. So anyway. The Neighborhood of Make-Believe. On the corner was a banker with a motor car who, with a wink, could turn pennies into cupcakes and salamanders burnt with laughter. My friends and I, in pink fizzing hats, lured hummingbirds and pirates on tinfoil chariots and zebras, stole his cakes and beasts when he sneezed. But the Crabberlocka Fishwife saw us steal, turned our treehouses back to matchsticks. We lost the gold that shined our hearts. And even with our magic capes, we could no longer leave the ground. The days of whisper jars in secret places under stones can only be spied upon by fireflies and puppets now. But the likes of them don't come here anymore.
Oh, Lenny De La Roca, you know how to capture magic without being saccharine. You really, your imagination is so innocent, really. It's as if the child never went anywhere at all. And yet I find that within these houses that you're making, a lot of relationships going on, because the we is very prevalent in your work.
Yeah.
Many times you're addressing another person, you're with another person. There's not much solitary behavior in your work. Do you want to talk about relationships, or do you believe this is unconscious on your part?
It is unconscious. I don't set out to say I'm going to write second person, first person, whatever. It just happens. And all of this really is some sort of magical prime. I'm not the only one to say it. I remember interviews with John Lennon and Paul McCartney and others who said, you know, I don't know where the hell this stuff comes from, right? It just comes through you. I mean, a lot of songwriters and a lot of poets, I don't know where it comes from. This is just passes through me onto the page. I don't know where it is.
I'm so glad you said that, because that is the most valid thing an artist can say. I mean, right now we're talking about where the brain stops and consciousness begins.
Right.
But the poet has always been in touch with some sort of something beyond himself. Yeah. We are not afraid of the invisible, and we're not afraid to say that things come through us.
Yeah.
So, you know, lock us up if you want. I'm so glad that you validate that. But talk a little bit about your writing habit. Like, you get up in the morning, do you write first thing? Do you write when you're feeling, when you're inspired by another poet, as you tell us? But what makes you, what triggers you for the poem? Feelings?
Yeah, things kind of stir inside me. I don't know how to explain it. I kind of feel like there's something going on in my subconscious, I guess, where it's sort of like percolating and there's something going on. And so, you know, sometimes I'll start, I always write with a pen. I don't I'll use the computer to type it up the first draft and then start to tweak it and edit it. But the initial writing of it is always with a pen on page, on paper. And so sometimes I'll start off and I'll start writing something. It's usually in the morning recently in the last few years since I retired, not always, but usually. And then it either makes it to the computer when I type it up, and sometimes I just throw it out, it doesn't work. And either case, what usually happens is if I just leave it and I come back in a week, whatever's percolating tends to all of a sudden come out, and then it just spills. Then it's almost like, you know, it's almost like, you know, lightning onto the page. It's just zoom, zoom, zoom. And it just happens. And then I always feel like, oh, great, this is so terrific. And then I type it up and I put it on the page on the Word document and come back to it later tomorrow, a few days. And then it's either, oh, this is garbage and I have to throw it out, or, okay, I could work with this, you know, and then I start to tinker and tweak and do all that. But I often go back in the middle of the night. A lot of times I'm a night person. I've always been a night person. So I'll often write something in the morning, but then I'll go back after midnight a lot of times and start tweaking it. For whatever reason, I'll go back late at night. My wife's asleep. There's nobody in the house. It's just quiet. And I'll go in and I'll put the headphones in and I'll listen to some kind of, minimalist music, you know, Phil Glass or somebody, or New Age ambient music. And then as that's kind of going on in the background, and I'll start to tweak it and shape it and whatever.
It sounds very much like a life force to me.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, why do we do this? Lenny De La Roca, why do we do this? This is like a possession, an obsession. What is it that happens to you that you have to do this?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I think I'm not the only one to say that. I mean, we don't know. I mean, it's just, I remember, you know, I had quit writing for 10 years back in 2001. I stopped writing poetry, reading poetry, going to readings. I just completely just stopped. I remember Lynn Lifshin told me once that she did that for 10 years. She just stopped. I ended up just not, and I didn't think I was ever coming back. And I gave away all my poetry books. And so for 10 years, I did absolutely nothing. And then after 10 years, all of a sudden, it just started to come back. And now I'm just like, it's fiery. I'm just writing, writing and writing.
And you're firing up a lot more people too.
Yeah.
So let's hear another poem, because I love your work.
Okay. Thank you. This is called Helena, and it's based on my nephew's daughter, who's named Helena, who died when she was, it was a crib death a couple of months after she was born. Anyway, this is a fictitious take on it, Helena. Death is the worst kind of insanity, Frankie says. His eye patch, a black sail in the ocean of his face. Trees fling red hairdos to the other side of the street. It's nothing of the sort. Death is an apple with a black worm in its core, she says. Why are the trains so quiet, Frankie says. He holds his daughter in his arms, her non-existent breath on his face. It could be another life where the air is so full of fall, nothing is able to fly. Are you my angel, she says, only in this photograph. Maybe we can walk a little further into the graveyard behind the church. She looks into her father's eyes. Yes, Frankie says. Red leaves pepper the grass with 1,000 wings. How long can you stay?
What an elegy. How long can you stay? Red leaves pepper the grass.
Yeah.
Red leaves pepper the grass, knowing that when leaves fall, they're going away.
Yeah.
That's one of your, do you think that's one of your best? You like that one?
I do like it. I don't know if it's one of my best, I suppose. I can't pick out and say what's my best, usually. I mean,
what does your workshop do for you?
Well, it confirms stuff that I think I already know. In other words, when I take a poem into a workshop with friends, I pretty much have it done. It's just a little bit of tweaking left, if that. And so what I'm really looking for is for them to point things out that I might have missed. And usually I haven't missed much. And some, you know, of course, sometimes I have, but usually it's confirmed. Like I might think, well, I don't know about this line here. Maybe I could, maybe that needs to change or come out or do whatever. And then if they, if a couple of them say, hey, you know, you ought to do this, then I say, okay, then I might, my gut was right. This needs to change. But often it's, I often don't make much changes after the workshop because I think I've got it nailed by the time I bring it in. Not always, but pretty much.
So. That's because you're an incubator. You incubate for a long time. That thing is working inside of you.
Yeah.
Hell won't have it. And by the time you utter it on the page, it has been really a process.
Yeah.
I find that to be
a time with them.
Mm-hmm. So these people that you're surrounded with are practicing poets.
Sure.
You have a journal.
Yeah.
And some of the other activities, I was interested in knowing how much was really going on in South Florida. So just give us a list of some of the things you're involved in.
Well, there's the, like I was mentioning earlier before we started recording, I mentioned the Performance Poets of the Palm Beaches, and that's run by friends of mine, Judy Ireland and Susanna Simpson. Judy happens to be one of the editors with the journal as well, and they run a monthly reading series. They have two featured poets and then open mic afterward, and I usually attend that. It's a great reading. They're not really, it's not really connected to the journal, but we're kind of joined at the hip. We're good friends and we always support each other. And then, you know, there's down on South Beach in Miami, there's the Betsy Hotel, and they're really, really great with supporting poetry. They have a what they call the writer's room, and they offer a residency each year, 5 days. And this hotel is, I mean, really, it's right on the beach, Miami Beach, high class. It really is a really swanky place, great. And so they give a residency for 5 days or so, and then they have readings. Whoever stays at the writer's room reads. They work with a group called SWIM, S-W-W-I-M, and that stands for Supporting Women Writers in Miami, and it's run by friends of ours, Jen Koretnik and Catherine Esposito Prescott, who are two great poets, and they push out a poem a day for those who subscribe to SWIM, and it's all women poets. And, you know, I get it in my phone feed each morning, and I read their poems. It's great stuff. And then they also work with us. I mean, we've had people read down at the Betsy as well.
What a wonderful world you're in.
Yeah.
What a wonderful world you're in, that which you have helped imagine and create and populate. Let's have another poem before we ask you more things about your journal. Let's have another poem. Lenny Della Rocca, and he has been writing since 1980, has two collections and two chapbooks, but is doing much to contribute to the world.
This one is called To Help an Injured Bird. And this this came a couple of days after reading an online story from Popular Science. And the quote, the little epi in the beginning says, "The ruby-throated hummingbird is a common window strike victim, especially after a storm." So this whole article was about how birds migrating south, especially during a storm, they get confused. And they hit windows, and a lot of them die, but some of them don't. And so this is to help an injured bird. Hold it close to your mouth so it feels your breath. Let it dream. Let it believe you're a goddess who can whisper pain gone, the way you sigh a man's body weight after a storm, his head against your shoulder. Millions of birds migrate in winter to summer homes. The journey exhausts them. Sometimes they take a night off to rest in towns, but lights and windows confuse them the way a man is confused by whips and lipstick, an attraction that could mean sex or blood. Many die on impact. Put the bird in a paper bag, for darkness calms this terror-stricken heart. Hum something you heard your mother sing when you were a girl. If there is movement in the bag, like a man surprised after waking in a strange bed, you tell him it's all right. It's only music that lulled him into love. Tip the bag onto cool ground. Let it compass geography and fear, because this is a bird after a storm, and you're humming so it remembers its nest. The way an infant remembers the womb, the way a man remembers his first love. Then, before it launches skyward, whisper a poem, so even if it flies all night, it'll know nothing on earth is certain. But for now, urge it to leap. Help it to race the moon. Help it shake off the stunning impact of your light.
Oh, Lenny, that was not written by any beginner. That was not written by any beginner. That poem shows someone who is seasoned, who has paid his dues. I'm telling you, we could teach that poem for metaphor, for inserting a story within a story, for the complexity of it and the purity of it. That is really nice.
Thank you.
Just having the hummingbird begin and the darkness and the terror of the bag to comfort it, and then how you seek freedom within form. It's a winner. Before we go to a final poem, we do want to go back and just gauge your knowledge a little bit. You have seen a parade of poets now for several years. What do you think is happening to poetry? Do you think there's a change of content? Do you think there is form, a change of form? Over the last few years, what do you see happening?
Well, yeah, as far as form goes, I see a lot of form coming in. You know, they've got a lot of younger poets that are going to villanelles and pantoums and guzzles, and they're playing with all these forms that, you know, for a while we just went to free verse and didn't see much, but there's a whole renaissance of formal poetry now. And the thing about it is not strictly formal, because a lot of them are playing with the form. I just last night read a poem. It was a villanelle, but it wasn't the traditional villanelle. The poet had taken liberties with the rhyme scheme and the actual lines. You know, just like a lot of times now, sonnets. I'm seeing a whole lot of people write sonnets that aren't the traditional Petrarchan sonnets or the Shakespearean sonnets at 14 lines. Sometimes that's all it is just 14 lines, and they're calling it a sonnet. It may not even be iambic pentameter. It's just 14 lines. I happen to disagree that that's the sonnet, but there's a lot of people doing it. And so there's a whole revival of formal poetry that's springing up, I see. And then there's a lot of poets, especially I think younger poets, who are doing all kinds of things with punctuation, with these dashes and these forward slashes and the breaking up of the lines. And the, you know, just all kinds of stuff on the page, much like, you know, I'm doing these e-poems or whatever you want to call them. They're doing a lot of things with punctuation, with the ellipses and all of this sort of. And then, you know, there's placeholder titles. You know, there's, I forget who it was, just did an entire collection, and every poem title was a placeholder. In other words, each title was in brackets. And I saw her read at the Palm Beach Poetry Festival, which, by the way, is another big thing down here every year. And she read, and then I asked her a question. I said, what's with the, because I hadn't known at the time. And I said, why are all your poems in brackets? And she said, that's a placeholder. It means that some point in the future, I'm going to change the title. But for now, that's what it's called. So, but yet the book was published with all the titles and brackets. So there's a lot of playful things and experimentation going on. And of course, we're seeing a whole lot of rich community of people of color, poets of color, that are really coming to the fore. Asian poets, Hispanic poets, and just from all over the world. We get a lot of Nigerian poets submitting to the journal, and just this wealth of voices from all over the world. It's just really incredible.
Oh, Lenny, thank you so much for what you do. You make us love poetry so much with your own work and with being a citizen in the Republic of Poetry, the way you are.
I like that.
Please give us a final poem.
Sure. This one is called 2020. And again, this is, you talked about before mining the past and poems pulling it out. This is sort of kind of a poem based on something that happened to me back when I was a kid on going to school. It's called 2020. Before I wore eyeglasses, black cats never crossed my path. Wicked spells in strangers' eyes never worked because the glow glob fuzz diffused the curse like a candle behind a cotton curtain, until I was the kid in the back of the bus who saw bully fists as waves hello. After bruises to the nose and jaw and two black eyes, I choked a boy blue in the face kicked him when his brown eyes kissed the floor. His height, a length of sleep until sirens blared close enough in time to bring him back, gurgling his eyes at me. "It wasn't him," his sister cried. "He wasn't the boy who beat you up. Are you blind?"
That is the voice of Lenny Della Rocca, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by MET Studios, Mike Turpin. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family with the support from the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.